From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
My stock answer was that if you failed enough exams, you end up being an actor, which is my case.
But then you've very strange plants called seagrasses. These are flowering plants, but they grow in salt water, and there's one with the lovely name of widgeon grass.
In 40 minutes, Concorde will be breaking the sound barrier high over Cork City to the clink of champagne glasses.
Coming up on this Singleton's Valentine's Day edition of Playback Daily, how to fail your way into a successful acting career, the creatures from Ireland's lagoons, and Concorde over Cork. Ray D'Arcy celebrates 1983. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show that has failed its way into being a Radio Catch-Up Show. On the Oliver Callan monologue this morning, there was focus, adulation and praise for one Irish teenager who managed the not inconsiderable feat of becoming the youngest player ever to score in a senior UEFA competition when he netted the winner for Shamrock Rovers against Molde in Norway last night. His name is...
Michael Noonan is the man of the moment across the media overnight. No, not that one. Millions and billions. No. This is a different fellow altogether. At the age of just 16 and 197 days, Michael Noonan, he is the king of the sports pages. He scored for Shamrock Rovers on his debut for the team last night and is now the youngest goal scorer in the European club competition history. What a way to start. It's a dream beginning. The Hoops won the match 1-0 in the UEFA Conference League clash, and it was against Norwegian team Molde last night, and that's the first leg of that match. But he's all over the papers. Irish Daily Mail: Hi Noonan, famous win for Rovers as youngster breaks the mould. Molde, but we let them get away with that one. New, as in Noonan, new kid on the block. That's the front page of the Examiner. He's everywhere in the Irish Times. Noonan's teenage kick gives Rovers a leg to stand on. Ah, beautiful puns. Striker breaks the European record on his debut to hand his side an advantage to take back to Tala, because Shamrock Rovers take this 1-0 win to the second leg clash, which is next Thursday, and it's in Tala. What an occasion that's going to be, particularly because Michael Noonan came up through the youth system in St. Pat's. Oh, they'd be sore this morning. But the whole thing beautifully serves as an advertisement for the return of the League of Ireland, a brand new season that returns tonight. Lots of fans excited about that one. And I think fewer than 300 Rovers fans actually travelled to Norway for the event. Alan Kinsler is one of them, and he is a lifelong fan, and he's on the line as he makes his way through a busy airport, I believe, in Norway. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Oliver. In departures here in Molde at the moment. It's not quite as boisterous as here this morning as it was last night.
Everyone's a little bit tired and emotional this morning.
Yes. That was fantastic. Fantastic. They're great headlines there you were reading out about Michael Noonan. Such a story. He was brilliant. That's like he won the, you know, was the lad who fouled him, got sent off and got the red card, and then of course the goal later on.
57 minutes, yes. I'm trying to hold on with your line, Alan. I know you're in an airport.
Yeah.
But you're a devoted fan, obviously, to go to Norway in February. It's quite something.
Well, actually, it was funny. My son booked, he's gone, he went three flights. And luckily, the members club arranged the charter, so I only had the one flight. So it wasn't quite as bad. But it's brilliant. It was brilliant. And it's a beautiful place. We're looking here at snow-capped mountains and a fjord.
Beautiful.
But very, very, absolutely beautiful. But the match was fantastic. Great atmosphere, great stadium. And Molde itself was brilliant. But it was great to get a win. It's huge achievement to actually get a win out there. Because Molde are good. They're a good team, good pedigree. So hopefully we'll sort them next Thursday.
You have your ticket for next week. You have your ticket next week.
I do indeed. And you've even in between on Sunday against Bowes. So hopefully we'll win all those.
That's a big one. Listen, Alan, we'll let you go. The line's not great, but thanks so much for chatting to us, and enjoy these subdued dreams and the way back out of Monday. And we'll be watching
with
interest. Yeah, it's been great season. And it's really good for the League of Ireland. Thanks, Alan. Good luck to you.
Okay. Bye.
Safe travels. Slán. As he said there, the League of Ireland brand new season is starting tonight. And what he was mentioning there is Rovers and Bowes are going to battle it out in the Dublin Derby, and it's on Lansdowne Road in the Viva Stadium. That's on Sunday at 2 p.m. Bohemians generously give up the home advantage there to showcase the biggest derby in Irish soccer history, they hope, to an even larger crowds on Sunday afternoon there. So that's it's kind of the right way to start after a really exciting finish to the league last November. And those league title holders, Shelburne with Damien Duff still in charge, they host Derry City. That's at Tulca Park tonight. St. Pat's are at home to Drogheda United, where Michael Noonan will be all the conversation on the way to that one. And Cork City host Galway United. All of that at 7:45 this evening. And there's ads around Dublin at the moment, a league of their own. So it is really all very good news. And we're talking about record-breaking transfers and stuff. So there's a buzz about the League of Ireland. Let's hope it continues and, more importantly, filters down to the national team as well.
I would have thought it should filter up to the national team, but I guess they're in such bad shape at the moment that it's probably fair enough to say down instead. What's next? Oh God, it's the US, isn't it?
Now, with all the news in America at the moment about Ukraine and the very serious stuff, there's all the kind of paddling in the background which goes on. And I was following the story about Greenland, which obviously Donald Trump has repeatedly talked about buying, says it's, you know, essential for their economic security and hasn't ruled out military or indeed economic coercion to take control of it. And of course, Denmark and Greenland have rejected, saying the island is not for sale, end of. But it hasn't stopped Congressman Buddy Carter. Now, Buddy Carter is a real congressman from Alabama, although his name does sound like a new Adam Sandler film about a lovable man dropped on his head who accidentally becomes a World Series baseball coach, doesn't it? And probably marries Amy Adams at the end. But Buddy Carter has come up with a genius idea. He is actually proposing a bill, written a bill, that will rename Greenland, because they're mad into renaming things, the Red, White and Blue Land. That's his plan. Now, there's been retaliation from Denmark with a bit of crack. They have launched a satirical petition, which has 250,000 signatures of Danish people. And they basically said, well, maybe we should buy California. And they say, we'll buy California, turn it into New Denmark, and we'll bring hygge to Hollywood, bike lanes to Beverly Hills, and organic smørrebrød. The kind of brown bread, to every street corner. And they said, a bit of a dig towards America, going, of course we'll bring our universal healthcare and fact-based politics to apply. And Buddy Carter says, no, Red, White and Blue Land, because he says Greenland want to be a part of America to celebrate the great freedoms, because it's the freest country on earth, even though 85% of Greenlanders have said they do not want to be part of the US. Kind of surprised 15% said they do. But nonetheless, most of the Danes are kind of treating it with the disdain that it probably deserves.
Probably. Come on, man. Sigh. Can we move on, please? No. Oh, great.
So, the country that's all about freedom. What freedom are they practicing at the moment? The White House has said that news organisations that refuse to use President Trump's new name for the Gulf of Mexico will be banned from presidential events in the Oval Office, the White House and beyond. They have blocked the Associated Press, that's an international pool of reporters, AP, blocked from attending events in the Oval Office and the White House's diplomatic reception room. Why? Because their very influential style book, in it, they said they're going to continue to use the term Gulf of Mexico, despite Trump trying to decree that an international body of water be called the Gulf of America. So they've barred the journalists. This has led to much roulia-boulia inside the White House press room, as you'd imagine, and asking, they've been asking, is barring the AP reporters just a retaliatory act, which is, you know, a breach of freedom of the press enshrined in the United States Constitution? And there's been a reaction from the feisty and fiery White House press secretary, who is Caroline Leavitt. Here she is, holding force.
I was very upfront in my briefing on day one that if we feel that there are lies being pushed by outlets in this room, we are going to hold those lies accountable. And it is a fact that the body of water off the coast of Louisiana is called the Gulf of America. And I'm not sure why news outlets don't want to call it that, but that is what it is. The Secretary of Interior has made that the official designation in the geographical identification name server, and Apple has recognized that, Google has recognized that, pretty much every other outlet in this room has recognized that body of water as the Gulf of America, and it's very important to this administration that we get that right, not just for people here at home, but also for the rest of the world.
She's very confident. I'm sometimes convinced by the things she says until you look them up afterwards. She's actually a fascinating woman, because she's the youngest ever White House press secretary, 27 years of age, gave birth to her first child last July. and said she took the job, decided not to go on maternity leave because she saw President Trump get up from his assassination attempt and carry on. And she said, well, I have to go back to work myself then, don't I? The six-figure salary had nothing to do with it whatsoever. And yeah, so she's quite an interesting figure. So obviously, it's an international body of water. He doesn't have the absolute authority to rename the whole thing. That's what the AP, the Associated Press's argument is. But as of now, they are still banned from most of the White House kind of press appointments and so on. Larger outlets have created their own rules. The New York Times said it's going to continue to use Gulf of Mexico while noting Trump's renaming and stories that discuss the issue. Washington Post said it will use the Gulf of Mexico as well in most references because it says it's not solely within the US's jurisdiction. The name of Gulf of America might confuse global readers. Fox News says it's going to use Gulf of America. Of course it will. But the AP said it's going to follow Trump's other renaming, which is reverting to Mount McKinley for the Alaskan peak. To Obama renamed it the indigenous name Denali. So they're going to go back to Mount McKinley because they said, well, Trump has the authority to rename areas that are solely within the United States, which seems like a fair enough comment. We're all about freedom. So except for all the people they incarcerate more than anyone else in the world.
But I'm sure they've got room for one more, right? That's Oliver with more bits from the flooded zone. And, you know, that's where we'll call time on the love-free Valentine's monologue for the day that's in it. This morning, Philip Boucher-Hayes, sitting in for Claire Byrne, had an item on Ireland's lagoons. No, I didn't know we had lagoons either. At least, I think I didn't. Wait, what exactly is a lagoon? Well, ecologists Brendan O'Connor and Killian Roden were on hand to set us straight.
Killian, do us a favour, please, so that we're all on the same page right from the very beginning. When an ecologist talks about a lagoon, what are you talking about?
Ah, we're talking about two things. One, the water in it isn't salt water, isn't fresh. It's a mixture. Two, there are no tides. It's like a lake. So it's a very odd thing. It's a combination between a lake and the open sea. And because of that, there are a large number of very specialised plants that only grow there. So that's, in a nutshell, what a lagoon is. It's a peculiar physical environment with very special plants and animals.
If they're not open to the sea, how is there an exchange of water between the rivers coming in and the salt water getting in as well?
Well, a whole variety of mechanisms. If you start in Ladies Island Lake, they actually breach the barrier with the bulldozer once a year. In my favourite lagoon, Loch Anavnine in Connemara, there's an actual channel between the sea, but the sill in it is so high that seawater only goes in on high spring tides.
Okay. Brendan, Killian has already declared what his favourite loch or lagoon is. What's yours?
My favourite one would be right in the middle of Galway Bay. There's a headland that sticks out called Tawan. And it's a place that's, even though it's very close to Galway and close to the research centres, it had little attention given to it by the various departments. So we went out there, Killian and myself went out there about two summers ago, and we found this most extraordinarily beautiful, off the beaten track, untouched, and very, very large body of water, which we now are very happy to define as a lagoon.
Describe it. Does it sit high above the water on a headland or where?
No, it doesn't. At high water springs, as Killian said, the sea level outside and inside are the same. But as the tide drops, and Killian mentioned that word, the sill as well, as the tide drops, that the ebb tide starts to fall away down below the sill, but there's still an outflowing system. And maybe one thing we could mention there too, those particular outflows were in one or two places used to drive mills. So there's one little lagoon out in Connemara called Loch Avulin, which is the mill loch. So that's another little interesting feature. There are sort of semi-uses for this outflowing stream.
Okay. This mix then of brine and of fresh water. Killian, who lives there? What plants does this encourage that are different from a distinctly freshwater lake or somewhere like Loch Hyne, which is an entirely saltwater lagoon?
Well, I think the joy about them is that there's a bit of everything. We'll go back to Loch Anavnine. You've a wonderful variety of seaweeds, but then you've very strange plants called seagrasses. These are flowering plants, but they grow in salt water. And there's one with the lovely name of widgeon grass, rupia, which essentially only grows in lagoons. And then my favourite, and organisms of all time, a group of algae called charophytes, which normally grow in freshwater, but a certain very special minority only grow in lagoons. So a mixture of everything.
And when it comes to the fauna, what fish, what crustaceans would you find there, Brendan?
You find a variety of both crustaceans, mollusks, they'd be things like bivalves, like mussels and oysters, and also insects. Quite a number of insects are specialised in living in these controlled salinity regimes. Animals that don't like variation in salinity are not found in lagoons. So things like starfish and sea urchins, for instance, that whole group of animals, you don't find them in lagoons because they do not tolerate fluctuations in salinities at all.
Where outside of Connemara would we find lagoons, Killian?
Oh, golly. Basically all around the coast. South Wexford had a wonderful variety of lagoons. Most of them are damaged, unfortunately. But then you go west, the coast of Cork, Kerry. In fact, every county in Ireland, with perhaps the exception of County Meath, have lagoons. And so, Waterford, Brendan has just pointed out to me, doesn't seem to have lagoons.
Talk to me about Broadmeadow in North Dublin, Brendan.
Yeah, that's the closest example of a lagoon that we can suggest that people from the East Coast can go to visit. It is what we call an artificial lagoon. Maybe Killian will fill in a bit more on that, in the sense that there is a barrier across it, which is man-made. But it nonetheless, because of the salinity variation and because of some of the plants and animals that are found there, it does fall into the criteria, the definition of a lagoon.
Anybody travelling on the M1, anybody travelling on the Dublin to Belfast railway line will be familiar with this lagoon, won't they?
That, you pass over that, exactly. That's one of the barriers to that I've described earlier on. So, yeah, that's the closest one. But the other ones then, as Killian said, are down in Wexford. There's three or four right down there as well. I think maybe Killian and I would also suggest that not every single lagoon has yet been documented for the Irish coast. And in fact, there is one out in Connemara called Comus, which Killian and I are both absolutely convinced is a lagoon. But we haven't yet managed to get a few quid to research it, for it to be defined as a lagoon.
How vulnerable are they, Killian, because of this unique mix of both salty water and fresh water?
They're vulnerable because of the fresh water. So many of our freshwater systems are eutrophicated. Now, we're using nitrogen and phosphorus like snuff at a wake, and not alone do we put it into our crops, we put it just about everywhere. A lot of that gets into the fresh water. Fresh water goes into the lagoons, and what can I say? There's no experience of nutrients on that scale. The result is the lagoons, they literally brew up. They go a green colour because they're normally limited by the amount of fertiliser, nitrogen, and now suddenly it's on tap.
Like snuff at a wake, a fine old Irish phrase you don't hear too often in these interesting times in which we live. That's ecologist Brendan O'Connor talking Irish lagoons with fellow ecologist Killian Roden and not at all ecologist Philip Boucher-Hayes this morning. On this afternoon's Live Line, Joe Duffy spoke to Gerard, who was selling his house in Ballyfermot in Dublin, when he got a letter from a couple who had hoped to buy it.
Well, it was a 3-bedroom house, but we got the attic extended and we've done a lot of work to it, kept it up to scratch and kept it nice and clean. We're very proud of it, but we love Ballyfermot. But it's a nice house, and it's well looked after.
Well done. So you put it up for sale, and interest?
Oh, it was amazing interest. There was only up for sale for a week, Joe, and it was sold.
Wow.
But I believe when we put it up for sale, my neighbour told me when we had to go off, when people came to view the house on the Saturday on the 1st, but there's only one viewing when it's a Saturday, and the neighbour next door told me, he said, there was supposed to be 60 people in your house. He said, it could be 100, he said, outside the front garden, all waiting to view the house, he said. He's never seen anything like it. So that's just to give you a hint of what happened that Saturday.
Okay, now, is there anything in it, Gerard, that your corner house, was there anything in it that would have generated extra interest, or do you think this is normal interest in a house?
I don't know, Joe. It's just it's well maintained. The house is. Yeah. It's a terraced house. It's not an end house.
Okay.
It's in the middle of the block.
Yeah.
But it's well maintained and well looked after. Okay. And we, as I say, we do keep it well. Okay. No, there's nothing special about it. Yeah, it's just an ordinary house.
You know the way I'm thinking in Ballyer, a lot of people have a corner house and they see the corner house, as you probably know, the garden is used to build an extra house. But you didn't have any of those extras, so to speak. This was a terrace house, 60 to 100 people at the first viewing, and sold within a week. And then what happened?
Then what happened was we went over to visit our grandchildren on Wednesday night. Mm-hmm. And we came back to the house just last Wednesday gone. And my wife happened to see... No, we have a letterbox outside on the wall of the house, but yeah. This was stuffed into the hall door letterbox, a letter, a note, and my wife seen it, and she took it out of the letterbox, and she proceeded to read it, and she said, she said, do you know what this is? I said, no. She said, it's a letter, she says, from a couple that viewed the house, mm-hmm. and more or less just poured out. To me, they sat down and wrote a letter to two strangers, myself and my wife, people that they didn't know, more or less asking them, would we sell them the house, or could... I don't know what to say, other than to say, Joe, that it's just heartbreaking, the way they worded the letter, and that they were telling a story about how they met, how long they've been together, and they said, we viewed your house, we got a good vibe, we spoke to your neighbours on the way up that day, and they said it's a nice area, and what broke my heart the most was, and I have to say, I get emotional even thinking about it, is they said, we could see ourselves having a family here because, you know, we want to start a family in that. Yeah. This we could feel the love in this house, he said. And but for two strangers to open up and tell, you know, the story, mm-hmm. like they were let down before. They said last year they were sale agreed on another property, and she said, I'm giving up, she says. This girl says, and but our chap says, no, please don't give up, he says. But I just want to highlight this today, Joe, just for the fact that people are sticking letters in. Yeah. In your letterbox, and people that they don't know, and I can't, you know what I mean? It's
a heartbreak.
Just, Jared, it's heartbreaking.
Okay, Jared, stay with us. Here is the gist of the letter. Now, we've removed any part of it that might make it identifiable, but I think, well, your words have given the heartbreak of it, and this is the part of the letter.
Dear owner, I hope you're keeping well. First of all, we want to say sorry if this letter is not of your liking, but we had to give it a go. We just wanted to get in contact to let you know that we fell in love with your house at the viewing. You keep it in such a good condition, and we could feel the love that you put into it over the years. We would like to tell you a little bit about ourselves and our story together, in case this gives us a chance when you're making your decision to sell your house. We met through work and fell in love a number of years ago. We've been in the process of saving for a house for the past 3 years. Our recent effort to purchase a house fell at the final fence. It was heartbreaking. On Saturday, we came to see your home. We are really looking forward to continue building our lives together, and we could picture ourselves having kids and growing our family in your home. We do understand how the market works, and we have to bid for your home. We hope to hear back from you, but if this is not the case, we appreciate you taking the time to read out our letter. Thank you very much.
There's tear stains on that letter somewhere, I can tell you, Gerard.
It's pull at your heartstrings, Joe. That's what I'm saying. Oh. Anyone that has a heart, you'd have to have some sympathy for that couple or for people in the same situation. It's just, I don't know what to say anymore. That's why I said I'm going to get in touch with yourself.
Yeah.
I wouldn't imagine it's an isolated incident. I'd say this is.
And your wife
going along.
Your wife, they left her full details, obviously. But your wife rang the woman.
She rang the lady last night. She did, yeah.
Fantastic.
And she said thanks very much for calling us. Even the fact that you called us back, she said, really appreciate it. And they said they were the, can I just, I don't want to say it, but they said they were the second highest bidder on the house.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they weren't the highest, they said, but if that never happened, would be considered, you know what I mean, would be considered. Yeah. So, but they were really appreciative that we actually rang them back just to say, listen, we got your letter and we read it and we're were so taken aback by it that when the fact that you wrote it, it's, you know, it's
took a lot.
It's heartbreaking, Joe. It is. It's very hard. It's sad. It's very sad for people out there. There's a sense of hopelessness, I think, for people out there like, trying to get a house and just to start the family. It's not too much to ask to start the family, to have a little home of your own and have your own children and to, you know, it doesn't seem possible anymore. I don't know. That's why I said I'll get in touch and send you in the letter yourself and see what you think of that.
And I don't know, when did you move to Ballyferma, Gerard?
I'm from Ballyferma, Joe, all my life. I moved to Crumlin, unfortunately, for 2 years, but I'm 63 years of age and I'm 61 years in Ballyferma, so, but I'm actually moving at the moment. That's where we're selling. We're in the process of moving. Well, it's up for sale at the moment, so I'm moving now. We're downsizing, Joe, so we don't need it anymore, you know. So we're going to a place not too far from where you were brought up, Palmerstown. So there you go.
Well, I was brought up in Clatagreen. And did you buy the house, or was your family renting the house?
No, I'm off. I came from Deasy's Road originally, Joe. My mother and father were off Deasy's. And I bought that house. Mm. There was only, I think, 30 houses built where I live. It's down the very end of Ballyferma. That's to give people an idea. But it wasn't a council house. It was a private house.
Okay. But they all started as council houses.
No, not this one.
But I'm just, you remind me of how important, do we need reminding, but this is such a poignant way to do it, Gerard, this letter especially. Yeah. And believe it or not, what I have in my bag and what I have in my hand is the deeds to my mother's house in Ballyframet when she bought it. And she carried them with her everywhere, believe it or not, because she rented a house from 1953, and she lived it until she died 3 years ago. And she eventually, wait for this, people are going, this is the importance of the councils building houses and people trying to better themselves and passing it on to their children. Mabel Duffy and James Duffy, this is their deeds here. I'll tweet it when they take out the details. They bought their house off Dublin Corporation on the 15th of October 1981. Okay? They'd first started renting it in 53. So that's what, nearly 30 years previously.
28 years.
And you know how much she paid for the house? $4,925. And she'd already been offered to buy the house a few years previously for a lower amount, but she couldn't afford it. So she paid off week by week the house and she carried those deeds.
Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line, talking about his mother buying her council house, having spoken to Gerard, who got a very moving letter when he was selling his house, from a couple who really wanted to buy it. The man who Oliver Callan described as the greatest actor ever to emerge from Cavan is in Dublin for the IFTAs, and he dropped into studio to talk to Oliver. This morning, he's Brian F. O'Byrne, currently to be seen on the big screen in Conclave. And after 30 years living in the US, he's now living in Ireland. He spoke to Oliver about where his drive to become an actor came from.
When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, there weren't cinemas around. There were no cinemas around. So I didn't really go to a cinema. We took our one family vacation in 1977 to London. We took over to see an uncle in London, and I saw Watership Down and Grease.
In the cinema? It's your first time in the cinema?
Yeah.
No way.
Well, no, I think once before I saw, I was in Thurles with my aunt in Thurles, and I went to a cinema there and I was really struck by the smell of popcorn, and I was on a balcony. I'd never seen a balcony, and I saw Death on the Nile. So that was it.
You're really not that old, despite what it sounds like.
And then I think I came to Dublin probably when I was about 17, 18, and I kind of discovered Screen in the Green, and I walked in and saw kind of Betty Blue and Blue Velvet, and was like, okay.
Right.
That's
blew your
different.
Mind.
Yeah, it did actually. It did. But I didn't think, obviously, growing up, I don't know whether you felt this, but I understand now people saying if you don't see it, you can't be it. Mm. I didn't know that Colchis could you know, I didn't see.
It was a different planet you couldn't get
to. No, you weren't ever going to be in.
So you had no burning desire to be on the screen.
Oh, my God, or stage or nothing. Yeah, I still don't quite understand. I mean, it's different every time now. I go, why am I doing this profession? Or why, how did I end up here? It's different as I get older. Something is revealed. Oh, maybe this is why I do it.
So what happens is when you go to America, is it because you go over there and what are you working at? You're in New York.
No, well, what happened was my stock answer was that if you failed enough exams, you end up being an actor, which is my case. And I ended up the second year of existence going to, because I had two buddies going to audition to get into Trinity College for the Samuel Beckett Center for the theater training that happened there. And I thought, gosh, if they go there, what am I going to do? I don't know what I want to do. It was before you were allowed to have dream of being anything in Ireland when we didn't have dreams. It was just like, and they went there and I auditioned and I got in. And that was it. And at the end of it, I went, well, I'm not good enough to be an actor. And then I won a green card that I hadn't applied for. My uncle had applied for, and I got to America. I was in America all of a sudden. And then I knew a guy from Cavan. Well, his family, because we were married into them, ran the Irish Repertory Theatre Company in New York.
Series of coincidences and amazing.
Nothing is planned.
A web of serendipities.
Completely.
And there you fall in love with the job.
Well, I don't know if I fell in love with it. It's what I ended up doing. I mean, yeah, I ended up doing it. And it's a fascinating life. You end up...
It sounds like there are moments you go, why am I doing this? And
oh my gosh, continuously. Continuous, like Conclave, like... That just things like that happen. All of a sudden, you're in the Vatican, and you're going, "What? Why am I in the Vatican? How am I in the Vatican? Like, this doesn't make any sense." This happen, you know, in theatre, I've ended up in Guantanamo Bay, or like being led through the prisons in Guantanamo Bay, going, "What am I doing here? How did this happen?" And it's nothing except I happen to be an actor, and you get led on these fantastic little stories, and because somebody goes, you could be right for this, and you've no idea why, and you just end up going, this is interesting. And so I think what it's given me is curiosity. And so, like, if you're curious about life, well, there's nothing else really, other than
step into
to be
people's
curious.
Shoes.
Well, you must know that more than anybody.
I do it fleetingly for comedy purposes.
Much more than fleetingly. You're quite remarkable what you
but
do.
But come here, no, thank you so much. Come here, when you were doing Conclave, it must have been quite, because it's shot in Rome.
Shot in Rome.
And everybody is in it, essentially, isn't it?
Well,
it's
like
weirdly
a cast
old, mostly
of
male
like,
cast.
Yeah, cast of... bald people. It was kind of wonderful to be around my, around my peers.
I didn't think of it like that.
Yeah,
actually.
No,
yeah.
It's just a whole bunch of baldies. Yeah, yeah. It was really nice, and it's a remarkable place. I know it's very interesting. Your complete fascination with the Catholic Church is obvious.
I'm telling you, that is all accidental.
Well,
but when you were putting on the robes of clerical power, and stepping into the incredible recreations they did of Sistine Chapel,
remarkable.
I mean, what did that feel like?
It felt good. It felt fine. I mean, it's fascinating. The Catholic Church is fascinating in the context that we're looking at it in the film there.
Yeah.
Because you understand, and if you're in Rome, because you just understand the power.
That's right.
And the power being an ultimate power in that it passes down. So I never realized that, like, kind of priests take a vow of loyalty, not to God, but to a bishop.
Oh.
And so you know that it all flows down. So
it's a hierarchy.
It's complete hierarchy, and so therefore, whoever is at the top has a profound effect, and and so the political machinations of the place, but it has profound effect on a world, on a global level.
Yeah.
So when you're in Rome, I'm sure you when you see people dressing clerical gear from all around the world coming for various reasons, whether it's a spiritual journey or whether it's a political journey, you realize you're in a place that with centuries of decision making that has profound effects on everyday lives across the world, and that's it's an unimaginable power.
Irish actor Brian F. O'Byrne talking about Conclave and the power the Catholic Church used to wield on Oliver Callan this morning. Back on the Today programme, and Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke to John Mark McCafferty, CEO of Threshold, about a new campaign from the Residential Tenancies Board to clamp down on an estimated 16,000 landlords who may be flouting rent pressure zone rules by illegally hiking rents.
Are you surprised by that figure of 16,000 landlords?
I'm not necessarily surprised. We see in Threshold when we're advising tenants around a range of issues, including rents and rent increases, that there are certainly instances where some landlords are increasing what appears to be above the 2% allowance. And that's why that's one of the many reasons why tenants come to us to kind of get our advice, get our analysis on the Residential Tenancies Act and how they relate to their case. So it's one of the, as I say, the many reasons why people who are renting and maybe worried about the possibility of even losing their home because they might not be able to afford that rent increase that they come to us about.
But the number, I mean, is it 16,000 rental agreements that might be being flouted or 16,000 landlords who may have multiple tenancies?
My understanding, well, I'm guessing that it's 16,000 rental agreements. Now, some of these may be legitimate increases over the 2%, where in some cases, rent has not been increased for say several years, or in certain circumstances, substantial physical change has been made to the house or the apartment. But I think for the vast majority of those cases, in our experience, it will be because the rent has increased either, because the landlord doesn't understand the rent the rental legislation or chooses to, see if they can get away with an increase above the 2%.
Let us imagine hypothetically then that they all are flouting them, whether through ignorance or connivance. Are there safety in numbers for landlords doing this? Because if you have 16,000 rental agreements, it's going to be an administrative impossibility, is it not, for the RTB to bring all of them in?
It'll be a challenge, but if landlords who are flouting the rules know that the RTB are beginning to really ramp things up with this kind of second phase where the RTB's compliance and enforcement team will be bringing cases of say ongoing and deliberate non-compliance, then that should have an effect on some of those landlords to ensure that they are mending their ways, if you like. So yes, 16,000 is quite a tall order, but in a way, I think it's really important that the RTB does make this move, and also it's a signalling to the wider sector that they are getting really serious about this issue of the flouting of the 2%.
Rental prices remain high because of a shortage. Frustrating for many people trying to get into the rental market then to see large developments with so many vacant rental properties. Is it time for us to start considering a tax on vacant rental properties?
I think it's certainly time for us to consider it. Tax on land and housing generally, I don't think has been used fully as a lever to really try and release the supply, either the supply of land, the activation of land, or indeed the activation of housing. I think successive governments have been quite shy in relation to fully implementing the full weight of tax on say, for example, housing and vacant housing. And indeed, I recall the then finance minister before Christmas, I think, delaying such a rental measure or a taxation measure. So I think that should be considered. I think we have kind of gilded the lily as a country in relation to the use of tax as a way to try and trigger, if you like, the correct behaviours in relation to bringing both land and housing into use.
John Mark McCafferty, CEO of Threshold, talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes this morning about the new campaign from the Residential Tenancies Board to clamp down on landlords flouting rent pressure zone rules. As part of his regular Reeling in the Ears series, see what he did there, Ray Darcy this afternoon took us back to the 1980s.
Welcome to 1983!
Oh! What happened?
Well, holy God, we got a new rural drama on the telly. A supersonic plane landed in Dublin, so too did an American president. A horse and a businessman were kidnapped, and Naas, County Kildare, was bypassed. It was very big news at the time, I can guarantee you. And this was a hit for Laura Branigan, Gloria. Gloria, you're always on the run now. Running after somebody. You gotta get him somehow. I think you got to slow him down before you start to blow it. I think you're headed for a breakdown. So be careful not to show it. Great song, Gloria. Remembering 1983 through news and music and, of course, your memories. 51551, WhatsApp messages to 0870-32-32-32. Joan Armit Trading.
I'm right on target. My aim is straight. So you're in love. I say what? Can change, there's always changes. And I wanna try some rearranging. I say, drop the pilot, try my balloon. Drop the monkey, smile my buffoon. Drop the Wahoo, I'm the easy rider. Don't use your army to fight a losing battle. Hey.
Great hit for Joan Armit Trading. And this was big for New Order. Blue Monday.
How does it feel to treat me like you do? When you laid your hands on me and told me who you are. Thought I was mistaken. I thought I heard your words.
Yeah, New Order and Blue Monday, the best-selling 12-inch of all time. What's a 12-inch, Mammy? That was released in March of that year. In February, the 8th of February 1983, Epsom Derby winner Shergar, valued at £10 million, was kidnapped from Ballymanny Stud Farm just outside Newbridge in County Kildare. The stable groom Jim Fitzgerald, along with his wife and seven children, were held at gunpoint while thieves made away with the prize-winning horse. This report from Michael Fisher.
Two gunmen entered the stud around 9 o'clock last night. The stable groom, Mr. Jim Fitzgerald, and his family were held in a back room at gunpoint. The gunmen asked Mr. Fitzgerald where Shergar was boxed. They loaded the horse into a horse box they brought with them. Mr. Fitzgerald was forced to lie face down in the vehicle. He was released 4 hours later. The gunmen told him not to contact the Gardaí and that a ransom would be demanded for the safe return of the horse. Ballymanny Stud is owned by His Highness the Aga Khan.
Shergar's owner, Aga Khan, died earlier this month, and the mystery of Shergar still unsolved. Yes, there's a use in hanging around. It's how you dress it to the town. I'll find a crowded avenue. Though it will be empty without you. The Beat, with their version of the Andy Williams classic, Can't Get Used to Losing You. Ah. This was huge in 1983 for Bob Marley and the Wailers. Buffalo Soldier.
Buffalo Soldier.
Reggae was big in 1983.
UB40.
It wasn't wine, it was champagne was the order of the day when the Concorde, the supersonic passenger airline, arrived in Dublin to bring passengers to Paris for the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. This is a report from Michael O'Brien.
Flight AF4842 out of Dublin Airport this afternoon was, to say the least, a little bit out of the ordinary. It brought together a collection of VIPs, including an ambassador, a Lord Mayor and a government minister. And it brought the crowds flocking to Dublin Airport. They came to see Concorde's high-flying champagne special and those who flew in it. Destination Paris, and the object of it all, tomorrow's Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. It was the first time that Concorde made Dublin Airport its port of call. In 40 minutes, Concorde will be breaking the sound barrier high over Cork City to the clink of champagne glasses. And the trip? The cost of it, a modest £483, almost a pound a mile. But that includes hotel accommodation, race tickets, and the chance to pick the winner of Europe's richest race.
Doesn't sound that expensive. After a fatal crash in the year 2000, commercial service was suspended and revived in November of 2001.
Yes, with Owner of a Lonely Heart, and it's from Ray Darcy's deep dive into 1983 this afternoon. Concorde over Cork, Shergar kidnapped. What an exciting year it was. Finally, on this not exactly love-filled edition of Playback Daily, the visiting critic slot was filled this week by Macra na Ferma's youngest ever president, Elaine Houlihan, who was tasked with going falconing, despite the fact that she suffers from a mild fear of birds. How mean.
I went to the Hawkeye School of Falconry. John and Caroline were running it at the Lyrass Estate in Kilkenny.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there you go. There's the posh hotel bit. And what do you do? What happens in on a falconry session?
There's a lot of birds, I can tell you that.
With lots of claws.
Yes. I suppose, look, we went out and we were flying them and they were landing on my hand and flying over my head, Oliver.
I have seen the videos and I was going, have we gone too far this time? She does. She is ducking very hard, no pun intended. But you met actual birds of prey. What birds did you meet, by the way?
So owls, hawks and an eagle as well. Is what
an
I was
eagle?
Yes. Quite big now. Yeah, huge. Yeah.
So the whole fun of it is that you put on the falconry glove, which is a big leather glove, obviously, yeah. The claws don't.
You put on a glove and then you go out in the field and we'll say the hawk that I was dealing with was Holly, flew up onto a branch of a tree, and then the minute you pop your hand, boom, there she is on the glove.
Really, the speed is something else.
The speed is ridiculous, and I think that's what scared me even more with the video that you saw. That's in slow-mo of the bird coming towards me and going over my head. And I was like, oh my God, it's not going to stop. It's not going to stop.
Really?
Yeah.
Now you're confronting your fears.
Yeah.
This is the positive spin I'm trying to put on it. What does John, is it? Who's
John and Caroline, yeah.
What does he do to call the bird in your direction?
It was like I was holding the glove, and the minute you pop the glove, sometimes we had a bit of food on it. And they came down and they were rewarded. But if not, it was just literally holding up the glove. That's the way they're trained. He has them so well trained. But I suppose going in, he wanted to make sure I was okay. And he brought out this tiny little owl that was smaller than a crow.
Cutest little thing.
Yeah, it was smaller than a crow. And even my reaction with that landing on the glove, he was like, okay. He was like, but he said I wasn't as nervous as he was expecting.
So, is the owl the starting point?
Yeah, so he started me with the owl. He made me sit down and all. I'm unsure, did he think I was going to faint or something here?
Fair play.
I was sitting down with this tiny little owl and I learned very quickly, if you don't drop your elbow, they'll keep going to try to find the highest point to perch.
I was
leaning that elbow down and my fist was up to ensure that owl did not move.
And if your elbow goes down, it'll just keep going up to
the
top of your
head. Yeah, it goes to the highest point. Yeah.
Is that a long eel, a long-eared owl? Do you know, was it the little owl? He was a beautiful little owl.
I was a small little owl now.
He was cute though.
Yeah, he was very cute now. I didn't really look at him too much. Anytime I looked over there, he was swiveling his head at me.
And then you work your way up to, what are the birds in between then?
So we moved straight from the owl onto a hawk. And I thought it was so funny. Like John went in to pick like Holly because he wanted to match our personalities, because he was like, okay, you're very nervous. We need to get a hawk that will be able to, you know, deal with you nearly as such.
So they got a nervous hawk.
I wouldn't say Holly now was nervous. Holly was having the time of her life while Elaine was there going, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I can do this.
And you did.
I did it. Like, and I suppose John distracted me so much throughout this. I didn't actually overly think about this till he started flying us over my head. Now that's when
he's holding a tree to the back of your
head. Yeah, he was standing behind me, as you can see in the video. And then, like, Oliver, if you saw it, like, the hawk was only a foot off the ground and just, like, swooped up in front of me and boom.
It's the coolest thing. It is real. They are remarkable birds, aren't they?
Oh, something else. Something else.
Did you experience the thrill or was it pure terror the whole time?
No, when I went out, we'll say after we did the owl and we went out into the open field, yes, there was terror, because obviously the wind was actually quite strong. So depending on what side of the wind the bird came from, if it was coming with the wind, you didn't even feel the bird land on your glove. But then if it was going the other way, there was a 50-50 chance the bird might try to land and miss. So I was trying my best. I was here like this, holding out my hand, making sure it's far away from my face. And he's a bit closer there now. Drop your elbow. I was like, oh,
yeah,
closer.
Get the highest point.
I'm like, closer. And then, it was really interesting to do.
Interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
Are your fears confounded now? Have you faced them?
Now, look, I would go and do falconry again because it's controlled, as I said to John.
Tamed
Unsure
creatures.
If I'll take on a pigeon walking
down
the street.
People who know what they're doing, like John and Caroline of Hawkeye.
Yes, I don't think myself and the seagulls either will be fighting at the beach, you know.
Now, you've really reached the thing that really has put the fear of God into people, thanks to Hitchcock and general dive-bombing seagulls that are in the wild. But the falconry thing, it's a cool thing to do.
Amazing. I didn't realise the sport is 5,000 years old. John was a fountain of knowledge. It's protected under the Irish Heritage Act too. Our president has put that in there as well. There was so much there. He told me it was a sport of kings. It's something that he's been involved in for years. And it was very interesting. And I suppose the information that Caroline and John were able to give about the birds. Look, I did listen to us all at times. I was more terror than listening,
but fascinating.
But absolutely fascinating, just seeing walking around and just seeing how well trained they are.
And imagine that's been paused now, of course, from Monday. And this is concern you as president of Macronal Firma. All poultry and captive birds will be housed amid the risk of avian flu. The bird flu has gone out. Are farmers ready? Have you been chatting to poultry farmers?
Yeah,
the
look,
impact of what this is going to do?
It's what we have to do for the poultry sector. It's mostly not going to affect for the free range flocks, but it is something that we have to do. It's a biosecurity measure. It's very important that we actually protect our poultry sector.
And we're brilliant at doing those agricultural controls in Ireland, aren't we? This is always preemptive.
Yeah, and I suppose it's great to see as well that Northern Ireland and the Republic are both doing the exact same thing as
oh,
well.
Brilliant.
So
doing as an
they are
Ireland.
Actually talking to one another.
And just in case anyone's wondering, John and Caroline and Hawkeye obviously follow all the safety precautions and everything involved, both your safety and safety in terms of bird flu. You mentioned the Netherlands where you went to college. What were you doing in college over there?
I'm a physio.
So
I went over to the Netherlands and studied physio for 4 years.
So this is your kind of great grow in life.
Yeah. So like, I suppose when I did leave and cert, I thought I wanted to do engineering. I went back, I repeated the leave and cert essentially for the crack because I didn't want to do engineering. I decided against this, went back, got ag science in UCD, and then I ended up in the Netherlands doing physio. But it's very funny to think that I got ag science. And I've ended up being the Macro president, but now I'm also a physio.
And you're going back to physio, aren't you? Because
yeah, I am indeed.
You've done enough, I think, 2 years. And it's a really busy job, president of Macro.
It's so busy. I was only saying it this morning. This whole week, I've been on the road at 5:30, 6 o'clock every single morning.
Really?
Going to events, doing different, I suppose, meetings, going meeting members. Like one of the days, I think was a Tuesday, I started at 5:30 and I finished up and the computer was closed. I think was this 5 to 12 at night. So I managed to finish it all in one day.
You should be on a cabinet minister's salary for that.
I could do with this.
But you must have seen every part of the country.
Absolutely. I have travelled the whole country. I've been back and over as well to Brussels a lot as well. Yeah, so it's been an amazing opportunity to have. And I suppose the elections have started too, Oliver. So I'm in the departure
lounge. Incoming
president.
Yep. You're in the departure lounge. Well, unfortunately, you don't get a ministerial big pension with it.
No, I don't.
But you're going to go back into the physio.
Yeah, that's the
plan. Physio job.
Yeah.
Macron Firma President Elaine Houlihan, newly minted falconry expert, and this week's resident critic, talking to Oliver Callan this morning. And that's all I have for you on this Valentine's Day edition of Playback Daily. Sorry about that. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, Playback, just Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has an altogether smarter, sharper, shinier look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until Monday, thank you for listening. And hey, happy Valentine's Day. If, you know, it's still Valentine's Day when you're listening to this, you know what I mean.